Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. And Michter's is the first American whiskey to be selected as Whiskey of the Year by Whiskey Exchange. Michter's, it's all about the whiskey.
You're listening to In the Drink with me, Joe Campanelli. When I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Fausto or our new wine bar, Lalu, here in Brooklyn. I'm really excited about today's guest. We have Giuseppe Vira, the winemaker of the Vira Winery. We're not going to go deep into the history of the Vira Winery. We're going to focus more on what has been happening the last 6 years. And that's because 6 years ago, Giuseppe was a guest on my old podcast on Heritage Radio Network. You can find that show at heritageradionetwork.org. And on that same trip, Giuseppe also popped by Levy Dalton's show, I'll Drink to That, and he had a really great interview with Levy, so you can find out all about the history of the GD Vira Winery on either of those. But today we're going to talk to Giuseppe about what's been going on in the past 6 years, last six vintages, some new acquisitions, some new things going on, and chat a little bit about the recent trip I did to Piedmont when I had the great pleasure of spending some time with Giuseppe and his family. Welcome back to In the Drink.
Ciao, Joe. Grazie for having me.
6 years later.
Six unfair years, because you look as fresh and young as 6 years ago, and I got all the gray hair. But yeah, it's great to be here.
You know what? The gray hair looks good on you. You've aged like a fine Barolo. Welcome back. So what has been going on in the last 6 years? I remember when you were on my show last, your family had recently acquired the Luigi Baudana Winery in 2009, I believe, and was the first vintage, right, that you released as both you working in the vineyard and also making the wines. So how has that project been going for you?
Well, yeah, it's been really intense and really beautiful in these years. The Baudana Winery has really given us a lot of joy. I always joke it's the most embarrassing winery visit you can get. And for us, the most embarrassing winery visit to offer, because it takes longer to open all the doors and all the locks that Luigi has placed over the years than the actual tour of the cellar. It's that small. And therefore, some of the improvements and dreams that we have is taking a little longer time just to make it happen. But the joy is to see Luigi and Fiorina are happy. That was our original dream, was to be their guardians, be the guardians of their story. And to see hindsight 10 years later that this is happening. Some people were like thinking, okay, these guys after 3-4 years, you know, they're going to just move the vineyards and become a Vira wine. And it's not. And it's never going to happen on our watch, because that was really the dream, to sort of make it happen, or let it be these older wineries that every family used to have just underground or at the basement of their own family homes. There's no more of them. And that is what makes Baudana so unique today.
I know you're a great student of the history of Barolo, and Baudana is a historic family in the area. So I think it's such an incredible decision that you made to leave the Baudana name on those bottles. They look very different from the GD Vira bottling.
Yes, you know, it's sort of a sub tier of what a small winery is. Here we're talking about a size where you maybe can only compare to Giovanni Canonica or Lorenzo Accomasso. You know, so we're really talking as artisanal as it can be. Bottling was done by gravity, by hand, just on the ramp outside the winery. So if it was a rainy day, you know, back in those days, you would not even have a chance to bottle. But that's exactly what we love about it. And that's why we don't want to change it. Clearly, every day you dream to make a step forward, to learn something, to translate that into a better farming and a better winemaking. But that's why it stays as a very distinctive identity.
What have you learned from the Baudana experience that you're able to translate to the GD Vira Winery?
Well, I think I've learned the most from my dad. So, for example, organic farming, it's from Vira that sort of trickled down to Baudana. But I'm going to tell you a little episode which I think speaks of who these guys are and what is the level we had to sort of step up to. Back in 2008, when we were sort of secretly dating Luigi and Fiorina, we were taking my sister's car. There was like a very anonymous Fiat Punto, for those who know Fiat Puntos. And, you know, just go to the winery and walk the vineyards and barrel taste and sort of try
you
to
mean they were considering selling the winery and they weren't sure if they're going to sell it to you or...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a long queue of suitors knocking on their door.
A lot of people wanted to buy.
Oh, yeah. Because the rumor spread that they were sort of thinking to retire. And suddenly everyone in their village sort of started knocking at the door and, you know, just asking, hey, should we go for dinner? Should we go for a coffee? And it sort of put them in a odd position when they're like step back until a friend said, why don't you talk to the virus? And that's how we met. And then again, we didn't want to sort of raise the dust. We didn't want people to talk about it. We didn't want to create interferences or rumors. So we sort of tried to fly under the radar, not being seen around, but yet go and meet with them and taste what they were doing and see what they were doing. And so we get to the vineyard and it's like 2 days earlier, there's been a hailstorm. In Serra Lunga, it didn't hit Barolo. As you know, it's a short distance. It's like 10 minutes, 15 minutes by car, but there's like two valleys and a ridge in between. So the weather you might have on the one side of Barolo doesn't mean it is the same on the opposite side. So we get there with this idea that we're going to see vineyards hurt by hailstorm. And we're walking through the rows of Ceretta and I see no sign. I mean, yes, you do see some signs through the leaves, but not on the fruit. But you also don't want to ask the wrong question to a farmer you're trying to make a good impression on, because, you know, that could burn you. So I sort of like went really deep into looking all, you know, as many bunches. I was like, gosh, I should see the hail signs and I don't see them. And eventually I just wouldn't see anything. So I had to ask him and I was like, Luigi, what did it happen here? We thought you had a hail, but, you know, on the fruit, I see no signs. And with his usual nonchalance, his usual like sort of lightness, it was like, oh yeah, we cleaned it. And by we, it meant his wife and himself, and we, who back then were like in their early 60s. And at the time, Luigi had a bit of a walking issue. So it was also not comfortable, not easy for him to work all day long in the vineyard. And to clean the fruit means they pull out every single damaged berry without touching the rest of the bunch. It's like an incredible work. So yeah, I think that is what we learned, that a love that could get down to the detail of caring about each berry and sort of pulling out, making sure that a broken berry, a damaged berry by the hail wouldn't affect the rest of the bunch and put it out. I think that was the greatest lesson we had from Luigi.
Wow. And it almost reminds me, you're telling the story of the winery in Barbaresco of Rivella Serafino. Do you know those? It's just a couple. I think they're in their 70s now. And
these are the jewels of our region. And it's not easy because, you know, today, just even say a bowling machine is out of this world. And we're in Piemonte, okay? So you're not going to borrow a bowling machine. So there are challenges.
Because everyone is very jealous and themselves.
Absolutely.
In way, yeah.
So there are challenges, but I think we should do an effort to protect those beautiful, beautiful jewels that we have.
I know today it's very difficult to purchase a vineyard in Barolo. It's expensive. And vineyards don't come up for sale very frequently. Was it also the case in 2008, or was that sort of a good time to be able to buy a Barolo winery and vineyard?
Well, yes. If you look with the eyes of today and with what has happened in the last few years, yes, it was definitely an easier time. And it doesn't mean that today you cannot find good possibilities. But it has definitely gotten to be a bit more of a challenging situation. So we feel very lucky it happened when it happened. Definitely today we would see even a more fierce and a sort of nasty competition. In going for Luigi Baldana.
But you were able to purchase a new vineyard just recently, actually.
Well, yeah.
Tell us about how that went.
That is Costa di Rose. Mm. And, you know, things happen. And then I always admire how it takes a lot of passions and a lot of hope sometimes to make it happen. So long story short, in 2015, we get approached by this gentleman. He's an engineer and he's actually been very successful in his working career. His grandfather was a farmer and that's why back in the 70s, he bought a couple of vineyards because he wanted to sort of keep doing on his spare time what his grandfather did. But long story short, he's about to retire. And he comes to us with the oddest deal possible. He's like, I want you to buy my Dolcetto vineyard and rent my Nebbiolo vineyard. And when you think with the lenses of today, that's awkward. He's like, what is this guy doing? But maybe he came to us because he knew we love Dolcetto. And so we...
You make two different wines of Dolcetto.
Yes, yes. So we love to do that, which is maybe not that usual to produce various Dolcetto when you're in the Alba region in Barolo. But to get a longer story short, we decided to go and see the vineyards. And the Dolcetto vineyard was actually beautiful and the Barolo vineyard was beautiful. And we felt like, okay, situation is changing here. Maybe we should go for it. We only agreed on conditions that we cared a lot, which was a very long-term rental, because that we felt was important to transition the farming to the type of farming we love.
So it wasn't organic and you're transitioning to organic.
Yes, yes.
When you say it was beautiful, you mean the exposition and the slope and the soil you really liked?
So talking about Costa di Rose, the first thing that struck us was the soil. The soil is a beautiful arenaria, which is a sandstone, basically, which historically is a soil that is less spread than the other two most important soils, which is the marls and the Formazione di Lecchio. So it's sort of rare to find. But then to find a vineyard which has that purity of arenaria, it's quite a unique place. I mean, when you get to the top of the vineyard, there's like a dune. And this dune, I mean, you touch it, is like pure compressed sand. So that was sort of the trigger for our fantasy, for our dreams to sort of produce a Barolo that would be different from all the other Barolos we were producing. Then when you sort of go back to the vineyard from time to time, I mean, more and more often, then you start to realize, hey, wait a second, this vineyard is right in between Canubio and Busia. Mm. Why no one has figured it out? But you also realize it is a much smaller designation, so there's not critical mass to be better known. There's no paved road, so you only go there with a bumpy off-road path. You better have a Fiat Panda to get there. So, you know, there are reasons why historically the vineyard, while having a pedigree, because if you look into the Renato Ratti map from the 70s, it was already highlighted, but there are reasons why it didn't sort of became more known. But really the triggering point and what still gets me excited every time I taste these wines is that sandstone component.
Wow. So you said you're renting some of them as long-term rental. Is there a big problem with, at the end of those rentals, people wanting to sell the vineyard to get a lot of money? And I've heard some stories about people who've rented a vineyard for a very long time and it was part of the identity of the winery, and then the new generation comes in and they have trouble because the new generation wants to sell the vineyard.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that was a slightly different scenario, because 3 years in the rental agreement, the gentleman actually decided to sell and we had the chance to purchase. And since we still had like 20 years of agreement ongoing, it was a sort of favorable condition. But those situations you're mentioning do happen. What can I say? I think my heart is for the happy endings. And when you hear, you know, one of your colleagues has lost a rental, I feel very sorry. But yeah, this is part of Barolo today. And I think we simply need to make sure as a collectivity, we mm-hmm. don't lose the soul of what we do. But things happen. Yeah.
Now that Barolo is such an internationally famous place and you can go there and see people from all over the world, how do you think you can maintain the soul of the area? I'm sure it's a very different place from when your father started, not very long ago, in the 1970s, right?
That is one of the questions I ask myself the most. And I think the answer is in memory, I would say. I would use this word, memory. Memory doesn't mean you sort of sit in a couch and think back to the past, but memory is sort of don't let it go. Don't forget about what we are about, and don't forget about the harshness that people had to embrace for generations and generations, and don't forget all the sacrifices that have been done. I know I'm a bit of a minority in this. Many people are sort of pleased and happy that we're sort of perceived as a great up-and-coming region. But Joe, what can I do? I feel as long as with my siblings, we can not lose the identity of what we do, with our team, one day with the next generation, if there's going to be a next generation, don't lose touch with the ground. And I think we're not alone. So we're a minority for today, but I think a lot of our generation that is sort of little by little stepping in, family wineries, does have the sensibility. So I actually think it's the future is promising to this end. But it's promising because of a newer generation that sort of has maybe different optics than in the past and cares more about not losing the heritage.
You mentioned Lorenzo Accomasso. Who else is of that generation, a little bit older than your father for sure, who can remember really hard times and what it was like in those days in Barolo? Who should I speak to get this oral history of the area?
Oh, there's plenty. I mean, these are older people. Renzo Accomasso has that sort of genius wit where he's like a real farmer, but he also has an ability to communicate. I mean, the first time I met Renzo Accomasso, who I knew by name, but I hadn't met before, he was sort of making the most moving speech I ever remember. This was about 10 years ago.
Where were you?
We were in a restaurant in La Mora called Bovio. And I was sitting down with some friends and colleagues. And then there was this big, big table. It was right before Christmas time. And this older guy, I mean, you know Renzo, you know, it's like you wouldn't think when you first see him that he can do such a moving speech. But he sort of got up the table and started talking to the rest of the people at his table and was like moving. It was 2008. So it was like the first stint of that harsher crisis. And he was telling everyone, you know, next year you'll come back from Vinitaly, you'll see you'll have orders, you know, things are going to go move positively. And it was like, he was empowering these people of a hope and, you know, telling them don't give up. And so I had to go to the summit and I'm like, hey, who's that guy? Oh, that's Renzo Accomasso, who I knew from stories, but it's simply, you know, I was 10 years younger, maybe not as interested in learning and meeting. And I had to go and say hi to him and sort of thank you, because I think fewer times I've met people with that personality and that positivity. Now, he's special. He's a bit of a unicorn, but definitely there is still people like you know, even Luigi Infurino Baudana, who can tell plenty of stories, and others. And then there's a whole generation of sort of silent farmers whose names people don't know. In fact, a few years ago, we started with my siblings a project to interview some of these folks. We had lost our grandfather and we were like thankful for all the stories he'd shared. And so we started to interview as a chance to learn and retain a memory of who they are and what we should honor in our work.
What are you doing with these interviews? Can people access them or are they just for you and your family?
Well, yes, the majority are published on our very humble website, which I'm not recommending. It is a very, very hands down website, but there's a section that we actually decided to call Radici, Roots. Because that was the purpose of that, of those videos, to learn better about our roots. And it was funny because it would take half an hour of like small talk because those people have never been on a camera. So it's sort of a lot of anxiety, a lot of emotions, which I still have it myself. But, you know, it was humbling. It was moving to see the genuinity of these people. And so we would talk a lot. And then when finally they sort of felt we could go, we would turn on the camera. And all these interviews have been done in their kitchens or living rooms. So, you know, the acoustics is definitely not perfect, but they were authentic. And the challenge is to sort of put the subtitles from Piedmontese to English, but some have already been translated and the others will come. Wow. But they're really moving. I mean, you see a lot of them, like at some point crying throughout the interview when they started to remind the harshness they had to go through in their lives. Now, I know we're not talking about the most positive things, but I think to answer your question, that's what we need not to forget.
That's incredible. I've been on your website and I've seen lots of great videos of your family, so I will I'll also check out the Roots section. In the Drink is brought to you by 750. 750 is partnered with the longtime print publisher of price books, Beverage Media. This is great news for all of us as buyers.
This means that you're going to have new account features, a growing and more robust marketplace, and better service for customers of both companies. Buyers are going to benefit from a comprehensive marketplace where products are represented more accurately than ever before. And as this partnership evolves, expect to see even more efficiencies when searching and ordering products, along with a more complete list of wines, beers, and spirits in your market. If you're not currently a buyer with 750 and you are a retail beverage buyer, please reach out to Matt at 750.com. That's 750 spelled out, and he'll help get you started.
I know we got off topic a little bit, but if you could tell us about the results from the new vineyard acquisition. What are the wines like, and the Dolcetto and the Nebbiolo?
So the Dolcetto goes on, let's start with Costa di Rosa actually first, because we are just releasing the very first vintage, that's 2015. And I tell people, you know, we're crawling, we're like just learning. It's sort of too early, and I feel embarrassed when I have to talk of a vineyard, because you wanna learn it year after year. But based on these few vintages we've done until now, what we see is that the tannins, well, it all starts with the sandstones, right? So an interesting point of comparison would be to think of wines from the Roero region, or wines from that hill that stretches between Castiglione Falletto, when you think of Rocca di Castiglione, and goes down to Monforte like Perno and some of these vineyards. But really, let's take Roero for a moment as an extreme point of comparison. What does sand do to Nebbiolo? The sand opens up the aromatics, so you have more of a red perfumes, you have more of that rose petal. And in terms of the palate and the tannins, it gives you a bit more of a grainier but lighter tannin. The clay is the component that sort of makes the tannin dig deeper into the palate. So when you do not have a lot of clay, but actually you have an opposite material, an opposite geology, you have more of the lifted palate. And so stylistically, the wine do have this sort of freshness and lift, and they're very intriguing, the aromatics, not as deep in the palate. And I find it unique in the context of the other wines we produce, of the other Barolos we produce. And then when it comes to the Dolcetto, that's actually off the spotlight. That vineyard is in Farigliano, which is in the Dogliani designation, which is considered to be where most of the Grand Dolcettos come today. It's the main
vocation. First vineyard in Dogliani.
And it is our first vineyard in Dogliani. We thought it was beautiful. It proved to be even nicer.
Wow.
But that doesn't go into any of the Varabolings. And we'll have to find out a new road for that fruit.
Because do you want to make three different wines from Dolcetto? It seems like a lot, or?
We definitely want to, although I know it sounds crazy, but we do love Dolcetto, and you know, it cannot be words. It has to be facts. So we're working on that.
Mm-hmm. You're a great admirer, I believe, of the wines of Quinto Chianetti in the Dogliani area. And he has unfortunately passed away recently, but another one of these great old timers.
Absolutely. Sure.
Did you ever meet him?
Yes, a couple of times. I would go there based on the respect, you know, my family would have for him. I would go there to say hi to him. And the sort of easy occasion was to bring the greetings and the wishes for Christmas. And it was a chance to sort of, you know, get to know him and talk. I think the sweetest memory we have about Quinto was when my dad was studying. And I think I never shared this story with you, but my dad was sort of this rookie that was, you know, just getting started, and suddenly he got a phone call from Aldo Conterno telling him, are you going to that tasting tomorrow in Turin? And my father was like, yes, I'm going. And you imagine.
And at this point, Aldo was already quite well known, well respected. He was the man, right?
Oh, yeah. And
your dad was just getting started.
Exactly. So you have like one of those, you know, masters and the leading figures of the region. And then you have this kid, Aldo Vaira, who's getting started. He's totally new and so on. And so the next day, Aldo Conterno shows up, and in the car, there's like not just one, but three people. And they get out of the car. And so Aldo was driving. Bartolo Mascarello pops out of the passenger seat. And then there's a third guy in the back seat, and he's Quinto Chianetti.
Wow.
And that's, I think, was the start of the friendship with these guys. And also the start of the admiration for Quinto.
I wish they had recorded the conversation in the
car. Yeah. Well, I'm sure it was like many questions, you know, just to check out that rookie.
Oh, you think they were like testing him to see if he...
Oh, absolutely. You know. Absolutely. It was totally about, you know, getting to know who's this guy. Mm-hmm. But Quinto's work, luckily, has now been lost. He's a nephew. His name is Nicola. And I'm sure that they'll keep producing some of the most wonderful dolcettos out there.
You mentioned the word organic, and I know that your family's winery was sort of the first certified organic winery in the area. And maybe for some time you dropped out of certification, but you recently brought it back. I wonder if you could tell the history of organic certification in Gudivira.
Imagine my dad was this guy who was coming back to be a farmer. He was under legal age. It was 1968. And people were sort of escaping rural life and escaping rural conditions. And that was sort of the unfortunate peak of like conventional farming as well, because it was such a mean life that whoever stayed there sort of had to try and maximize the crop. But my dad is going to college, because that's the deal with the family. A few years in, like we're talking 1970, he's going to college because the deal with the family is like, okay, you can be a farmer as long as you continue your studies, because they were sort of afraid. They wanted a parachute for their son. And so he starts studying, and he met this professor. I'm sorry, I don't recall his name, but he was sort of one of the earlier people who were interested and curious about organic farming. And that's how my dad embraced it. The association was called Suolo e Salute. Suolo is the soil and salute is health. And it was about that idea that a good health could only be associated with a healthier soil. And so in 1971, he got this, I mean, I call it certification. I don't even know if it's fair, because back in the days, it was, you know, the amount of bureaucracy was maybe less, but it was definitely like number three in the region. And it was the first winery. The other two farms were a cereal farm, like a grain farm, and a hazelnut farm. And I'm sure we still have those paperwork somewhere in the messy office we have. So then we run on that that certification until the 90s. But then around 93, my mom had a bit of a health situation. And I'm sorry, I'm sharing a very personal detail here. But, you know, my parents had three young kids and more important stuff to look after. And so they sort of dropped the ball on the paperwork. They decided we better keep farming organically. But it was just too much. And luckily it was a happy ending and a very, very shift, return to normality.
The farming didn't change.
But exactly.
Do the bureaucracy. They didn't fill out the paperwork.
And then it was just as small of a team to sort of add one more piece to the table. But
seems to be great now. Right?
Oh, yeah. No, luckily, she's... It was super... We feel super blessed. So then 3-4 years ago, having all the siblings involved, we were like, okay, guys, this might be time we actually go back to where we paused. And so we decided, you know, it's 3 years process to go back to the certification. No matter if the farming is organic, it's low. And so 2019 is actually the first vintage that is going to be certified again. So yeah, nothing has changed over the years except for that certification. But we also think we sort of owed it to our story. There were, you know, one of the sweetest memories about that is when I was 7 years old on the school bus coming back home. In realizing that day that the only vineyards with grass, we call it cover crop, but it was a seven-year-old. So the only vineyards with grass at the time were ours. And it was embarrassing. It was like, what are we doing different? You don't want to be different when you're seven. You're like, what are we doing wrong? So in those days, grass was definitely not a value. I mean, you've seen it today.
I've noticed since my first trip in Barolo and my last trip a couple months ago, it seems like everyone has grass. Everyone has growth between the vines now, almost everyone. But it wasn't like that even not that long ago.
That's beautiful. But that's sort of also why we wanted to make that farther step again. So definitely having 50 years of like soil that has been nurtured like that is beautiful. Back in 2009, when I was studying college, my dad gifted me a whole winter of biodynamic lessons. And it was, you know, was this sort of gift that you know is a gift after a few years. Because back then I was like missing on soccer games and missing on partying. It was actually two of us of the region. I'm sure you know Nicoletta Bocca, Sanferrello. She's a producer in Dogliani. It was the two of us.
I also visited her on this trip, yes.
So we were officially, the two first students being the one community that would study that biodynamic course. And some of that we've adopted, some we have not. We don't consider ourselves but a biodynamic winery, although we use like 501, which is a silicate.
There are lessons to be learned from it, even if you don't use everything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And one of the interesting stories you were telling me was when we were visiting the Brico delle Viole vineyard for, I think, one of the truly iconic greatest Barolos. And so your highest altitude vineyard at something like 400 meters. The vineyard just above it, which I believe is Giulia Negri's vineyard now, right? At Serra Denari.
Her vineyard is is on the other side of the slope.
Yeah. The other side of the slope, but very close by and a little bit higher up. But at that high level, that was Brico delle Viole, from what I remember, is almost the highest altitude you could be in Barolo. And now they've since increased the altitude that you can do.
Yes. I mean, until not far ago, once you reach 480 meters, that was the Chamber of Commerce would consider that was too high. And in fact, back in 99, we wanted to plant a Nebbiolo vineyard, which in our view was not even meant to be a Barolo vineyard, but simply high elevation fruit Nebbiolo. And they did not allow us to go for it. So definitely the situation has changed ever since. And especially Serra Denari is sort of the proof of these. And this has been a very interesting news, I think, in the way that the lawmakers view how climate is evolving. And I think overall is positive. So, yep, there's a little regret for not having been approved back in those days. But there's also there's also happiness that eventually they figured it out.
Yeah. You had the vision. Was the idea that you just wanted to make high altitude Lange Nebbiolo, or was your family already thinking that the climate is changing and this is what the future is?
I don't want to sound pretentious, but we definitely were more exposed to the idea that something was changing, even just by talking with colleagues. Although for a long time, I was not very comfortable calling it a warming. But we were more exposed to that observation and that shared observation where you not only would think something, but you could compare and you would hear other experiences from other vineyards, other regions than the lawmakers. So yeah, that was part of the thought process to plant high elevation Nebbiolo. And overall, it was also about the idea of a more lifted fruit.
I imagine when you speak with winemaker or with people who've been there for so long, they say not only did we have to maybe live through World War II and the wines of Barolo not being on the market, something that was highly sought after, but the vintages in the 70s were so challenging, right? And now having so many vintages that are a little bit easier, like they're better quality vintages generally. It's probably, if I think, your kids have it so easy.
Yeah, well, we still have our own challenges, let me say that. But there's no doubt, we've been blessed. I think the patterns have changed. I mean, even one observation I was sharing recently is that, you know, I used to remember as a kid, most of the hailstorms would come from the west, and now they come from the east. And that is quite a big shift for weather. But yeah, definitely, we have gotten from a situation where you might have had 5-6 challenging, if not bad, if not terrible vintages in a decade, which was the case in the 50s and 60s, to current times where you definitely see warmer vintages as a whole and sort of, let me say, easier vintages in general, you know, with a few exceptions, but easier vintages. Mm-hmm. So that's been quite a change in the last 20, 30 years.
I know the old story about the best vineyards in Barolo were always where the snow would melt first. So the warmest vineyards that had the most exposure to the sunlight. But it seems now that as the planet is getting warmer and Barolo is getting warmer, that maybe those aren't necessarily the best vineyards, the most famous ones, that most revered ones. Maybe those are the best in like cool vintages or moderate vintages. But now that we have more warm vintages, do you think there will have to be a recalibration of what we think are the great vineyards?
I do think so. And that's why there's been a push and sort of an underground push still today from some wineries to get to the point where Barolo has an official hierarchy of vineyards, just like in Burgundy or, you know, some other wonderful regions. But we believe the situation is really different. I mean, to start, we're talking a very complex microclimate as a whole region. It's not one exposure, but you have at least three exposures. And with such a situation evolving, we just got to be wise and patient and not just try to put labels on things. But we wanted to go one step farther. So what we did a few years ago was to ask the help of our local university, the viticulture faculty, to study in detail what was happening on different slopes. And in short, the historical Grand Crus or better vineyards of the region all laid on either a south or a southwest, and the melting of the snow was certainly part of the reasons why. But it was also about capturing more light and more heat in the fall. Now, what we've learned through these studies, we ran this research over 3-4 years, is that in some of the warmer vintages, the southeast does get more light, but lower peaks of temperature than the southwest. So it's definitely sort of the research proved the empirical observation that the west spots do get more heat, but sometimes that might be a little too much in some of the
warmer
vintages.
You get more southeast, you might get that good phenolic ripeness, right? You get the good flavor ripeness, but the alcohol won't be as high because the sugar ripeness isn't as high because it doesn't get the warmth.
Exactly. And also once you reach certain temperatures in the region of like 35 Celsius, which is not very ordinary. I mean, throughout the summer, I don't think we had more than like 5-6 days at 35. But when you reach those temperatures, you start to break down the aromatics, you start to break down the finer polyphenolics. So it's sort of really a limit you don't want to depass for long or for many times. So yeah, so I think this is very interesting and opens up to something that has not been learned yet and something to be discovered for the future.
And how were the last few vintages since I spoke with you? It was actually almost 6 years to the date. It was early September 2013 we last spoke. So we don't know necessarily how 2013 was at that time. And so what have the vintages been like?
Well, the first change is I no longer travel in early September, but...
because there are harvests that are happening in early September now.
Well, yeah, but also my responsibilities or my need of the wineries change over the years quite a bit. But I'd say these. Let's go in order. 2013 was turned out to be a beautiful vintage. Hindsight, I think the secret of 2013 was that we had a lot of rain in the springtime, and that sort of decreased the amount of flowers that turn into berries. And therefore, we had a head start with low yields. But then we had a cooler climate, and we had sort of that structured vintage that has become, you know, so a great favorite of people who love long aging potential wines. And then we had 2014. And 2014 is one of the vintage I feel closest to my heart.
It seems like a controversial vintage.
It is totally a controversial
people
vintage.
People feel very
right.
differently about it.
It is controversial. I mean, if you ask me, was this the best vintage of the decade? Clearly was not. It was maybe the most challenging vintage of the decade so far. But here's what I think is the untold story of 2014. We definitely had a cold season. We definitely had hailstorms. But we also had quite a beautiful Indian summer in September. So the secret, if you let me call it the way, of 2014 was to keep faithful through the tunnel of July. I recall that we had thin layers of snow falling down on the ground up in the mountains in the middle of July, which is, I haven't seen it before or after. So it was definitely like a record cold mid of the summer, which slowed down ripening. But that Indian summer got it back in terms of the chance for phenolic ripening. So what we miss in 2014 is total overall heat, and the wines tend to be leaner and lighter. But they certainly don't lack phenolic maturity. If anything, I think they have more pure aromatics when it comes to a sort of an old school aromatic of Nebbiolo. And yes, you got to be a bit more selective. I think there's maybe wider variability among bottlings, but...
Depend on picking decisions, what the big variability? Yeah.
I think it depended, especially in that tunnel of July. It was like, you kept working hard, if you worked on Green Harvest, or if you sort of said, okay, this is a bit of a lost vintage. Now, I'm talking generally. There are specific situations like hailstorms, which are never across the region. So when you talk to producers from Castiglione, for example, they usually feel like they've been beaten very hard. But if you go into the detail, I think there are some beautiful wines from 2014.
And we have a few vintages to get through, but I'm just reminded of you saying, tell me if I'm correct, but I think you said that Nebbiolo really shows its character, its greatness in challenging vintages. Am I right in remembering this?
Yes, which I'm sure was quoting someone else because I don't have all the wisdom, Joe. But yeah, absolutely. I think a word I'm learning about Nebbiolo is resilience. I could say that about even Costa di Rosa. Costa di Rosa is a sandstone, but then in a warm vintage, it doesn't feel the drought or it doesn't get into a stressed situation. It's really a grape that has a resilience. And I think part of it is the late ripening pattern. So it sort of can take bigger risks, but also can even wider situations. So yeah. Well, quite different from 2014 was in 2015. It was sunny, it was a bit early, but break. Everything about 2015 was on the earlier side. And it was a sort of relief because the wines were easier. I'm sorry, let me say, the farming was easier. And I think for us, the challenge of 2015 was sort of, and don't quote me on this because I don't ride horses, but it was like riding a thoroughbred and the animal is going at full pace, running as fast as it can. But you see a curve and the road is approaching and you sort of have to pull the reins a bit because you cannot just face the curve at full speed. And I think that was a challenge with 2015, realizing that it was warmer and sort of slightly anticipated. Our decision in the picking was sort of pull the reins and pick sharp on time. I think in a kitchen you can say al dente. It was that idea of like, I'm not going to let the fruit overripe. So I think on the short run, this has created wines which are not as showy or juicy or, you know, loud as we could have created. But I think in the long run, this has helped us preserve more freshness and more finesse to the wines. 16, I'm going to skip it, okay? Because 16, everyone talks about 16 already way too much. So, I mean, let's just say it's a vintage that is really exciting because it's mineral, because it sort of checks all the boxes of like a long season. But I think we have to watch out for 17 and 18, which, in my opinion, came as more challenging seasons, but could provide some of the more thrilling wines recently.
And I just want to finish. You shared a story with me that I found to be really beautiful about when you were a teenager and you were trying to decide what you wanted to do with your life, with your career. And you asked your father for some advice. And I'd love it if you can share that with our listeners.
Well, yes, it's very personal. But to start, we grew up from, you know, two parents were quite the anarchists of their own days. So they never told us what to do. They only had one requirement. Whatever you'll choose in your life, be passionate. And so I still remember many of my dreams as a kid. I wanted to be a carpenter because I saw a carpenter making a wonderful table. Then I wanted to be a firefighter, as I guess many kids. And once I really approached the time I had to make a decision for my college, it was either heart surgery or winemaking. And I actually did pass the exam to go to medical school. And once you pass, you have like a limited time window to sign in or leave your seat to, you know, to someone else. So the night before I had to show up in Turin to sign myself in, I asked my father, Papa, what is the social purpose of our job? Because I sort of wanted to do something useful, but I still loved wine. I'd been farming since I was 15 and I was really torn. And my dad stood silent for like what it seemed a long, long period. It was maybe, you know, 20 seconds, but it seemed forever. And many years later, he told me he actually never thought about that question. He just chose it because he loved it. He loved being out in the wild. But eventually he replied to me, Giuseppe, first of all, if you want to save lives, go for medical school. But then look at that. And he sort of pointed out to a painting my parents still have in their dining room. We don't need it to live. So as we don't need music or poetry or literature or a beautiful meal to live. But what would be life without beauty? And that was the end of our conversation. And it was really the end because I had no answer. I mean, I kind of knew what he was saying, but it sort of opened up an even bigger question about my life. And those few hours, I still had to make up my mind. And then the next morning, I drove to Torino, still torn. It's either this or that. And the fear was like, the exam to go to medical school is very tough. So I was like, okay, I might miss on this opportunity forever. Because then what if I go to winemaking school and I realize I don't really like it and I actually want to become a doctor. But eventually I got the highway exit that leads you to Grugliasco, where the agrarian faculty is. Because that question was like also starting to answer my desire for wine to be full of sense, to be full of purpose, and to be a purpose that was not barely hedonistic, definitely not economic, but there was let me call it a bit of a mission, if you will, a bit of a something you can do for your own joy, but for more than just yourself. And I went and started winemaking. And if I just, well, this would be the story, but if I just may add one little piece of it, the first few weeks were beautiful. I mean, I would love to go back to those days, not only because I sort of really loved what we were studying, but because every day I would come back and I had to ask myself the question, Giuseppe, are you happy? You know, and every day I was a very clear yes. And that sort of proved it was the right thing for me. Still today, that's what I ask myself and that's what I ask my team. And that question has not just remain my question, but has sort of become the questions we all ask ourselves. That's why we do what we do.
Well, I'm so glad that you made the decision to be a winemaker. It's benefited me and my restaurants quite a bit. And I'm so happy you've brought so many beautiful wines into the world. And thanks to your father for that. It sounds like unknowing, but great advice.
Grazie. Grazie, Joe.
Thank you so much, Giuseppe.
To everyone who loves beauty in life.
Thank you so much. And you can find the GD Viro wines at my restaurant, Fausto. We'll probably be pouring them by the glass again in the fall. We love pouring the Albe by the glass when the weather gets a little bit cooler. And if you are in Piemonte, I highly recommend seeking out Giuseppe and his family and going over to say hi. But in the meantime, drinking the GD Viro wines here stateside, where you can find them in maybe almost 40 states. Like they're around. They're one of the best wineries that are also well distributed. They're so good. Thank you so much for listening. This has been In the Drink with Joe Campanelli.